next talk is by Joel Gruber from Western Illinois University. He's also going to talk about experiences with university research farms. Joel.
Let's turn off the light. I was going to start with a question for Jessica, which I will just pose to all of you, and maybe if one of you sees Jessica, you can ask her. This guy, Lou Grant, obviously invested considerably in sampling every single year for many years, and I'm wondering whether he used that information at all for his management. So if anybody sees Jessica, maybe you can ask her that. Okay. I'm out at Western Illinois University, and I'm going to talk about the experience that I've had in just the last 3 years with the research farm that I'm managing. But I'm also going to talk a little bit about some of the other university farms or college farms that I've been associated with. So just a very quick overview. I'm currently at WIU, Western Illinois University, but the very first experience I had with a college farm was the Hampshire College Farm Center, Amherst, Massachusetts, back in 1994, where I was a farm manager. Then I was in North Carolina for a number of years, and I managed a student farm that was part of the Center for Environmental Farming Systems in Goldsboro, North Carolina. And I also was a community college instructor at Central Carolina Community College, where they have a land lab. Now, when you think of university organic research farm, you might be thinking of a research station. And, you know, we heard about a research station from James, but I guess my perspective is I'm thinking more of the student farm concept. But student farms, of course, are extremely variable. Some of them have no research at all and are really managed like just like a production farm, maybe not with the same bottom line. But I would encourage any of you who are interested in kind of going farther beyond what I talk about to take a look at this directory, Farming for Credit directory, on the New Farm website. And there are actually about 100 farms that are listed now. So I'd like to go through all of these and identify which ones have a research component. And it's quite substantial, but I haven't gone through them all yet. So just to start off with my foundation, back in 1994, I had graduated from my undergraduate degree in chemistry. A couple of years before, I was trying to figure out what to do with myself, and I did a farm management internship, and it was a truly formative experience. I got to manage a farm as an intern, and I collaborated with another intern, so it was two of us managing this farm, and it was a very unique experience. But I can easily understand why they have gone away from it, from offering interns the opportunity to manage a farm, because while I think it did work very well our year, the next year I mailed $20 to the two farm management interns and said, please send me some photographs. I miss this farm so much. And they sent me some photos that were not labeled, and I couldn't see any crops. There were just weeds. So they decided, I think, that the lack of continuity did not work for this farm. But the experience that I had, the formative experience of being involved not just with managing a farm, but also working with the faculty there, really pushed me towards becoming an agricultural scientist. So the very next year, I started a graduate program. Okay. Another farm that I'll just very quickly mention and recommend that you go to the website if you want more information. When I was involved with this farm, it was the very first 2 years, 2000 and 2001, it was called the CEFS, or Center for Environmental Farming Systems Student Farm. It's now shifted to the small farm unit, and it's no longer part of the organic research unit at CEFS. They've been separated, but it's part of a much larger research institution, over 2,000 acres of research ground, and I think right now they have about 100 acres of organic research. Okay, and the Central Carolina Community College, very interesting program, very hands-on program that started really with just very talented organic farmers in the area teaching continuing education classes. And those classes then turned into a degree program. And while I was still managing the farm down at CEFS, I would drive 85 miles out to Central North Carolina, and I started teaching here, and I had a wonderful time. They do have a land lab, a small farm that's about a little more than an acre in size, and they actually do a small amount of research there as well. But it's mainly hands-on production activities. Okay, and I was pleased to take a look at some of the information about how this land lab is doing today. This woman, Cheryl McNeil, who is the manager now, was one of my very first students, the first class that I taught there. Okay, so stepping back to my formative experience at the Hampshire College Farm, I think this is a great example, one of the oldest college farms in the United States, great example of how college farms have really served a student body as well as served research purposes. When I look at that stipend, $4,500 for the summer, I was paid considerably less than that back when I was managing the farm. Not for the whole year, but for that summer period. And if you look down at the bottom, it says assisting Hampshire College professors with on-farm research. And there was definitely some very interesting research going on when I was there. And I enjoyed last night searching through the literature for examples of research that have taken place in the last 15 years. So they have a very strong CSA, community-supported agriculture program at Hampshire that kind of connects, you know, far more than just the people who work on the farm, but also many of the students and faculty, connects them to the farm because they are patrons or members of the farm. 210 members now. It was about half of that when I was managing the farm. And this is just an example of how here you have a farm that has only a three-month CSA season. They have a fall CSA, which is just focusing on serving the faculty and staff. Now, that was the case when I was there. We had a longer season, but we only sold to the campus community because we did not want to compete with the local CSA farms, and there were actually probably close to a dozen within about a 15-mile radius. I don't know that that's the case today, but I'm guessing that they still have that focus on just serving the campus community. But I think this is an example. I'd love to talk to the current farm manager and just hear about how they plan all their crops so they really do their harvesting just during the fall semester. This is an example of a peer-reviewed article that came out of some research that I was involved with when I was at this farm. We could see Ruth Hazard, she's an entomologist at UMass, but the very last author, Ellen Sedlecki, was one of the student workers that worked for me, and so she's also part of this article. They were looking at basically how to control corn earworm and other ear pests in sweet corn, and they were looking at how to use oil mixed with various things applied to the silks of the corn. They ended up getting a patent. All of this took place after I left, but I was involved with the original field trials as the manager of the farm. And now they have a product, a commercial product. I don't know, anybody familiar with this product, the Zeolator? Not sure if it worked for you in West Virginia, but the early prototypes worked very well for us. We were getting 90%, I was pretty close to 90% control when we had oil mixed with BT. And a very interesting part of how this project turned from biological research into an actual application, a commercial product, is that at Hampshire College they had significant funding from what I believe was the most prolific inventor in U.S. history, a guy named Lemelson, who had, I believe, a son who attended Hampshire College. Anyway, he put up funding to support basically teaching people how to be inventors, how to develop practical products that could meet socially responsible needs. You can take a look at the specific mission of the center: to provide students with an experiential education in applied design, invention, and entrepreneurship through engagement in applied design problem solving for social responsibility. To me, this is such a great example of how we can connect the biological sciences to actual product development. And that, you know, the Zeolator would not have turned into a commercial product without the Lemelson Center, or it would have been a much more prolonged process. But students developed the actual mechanical technology through working with the Lemelson program. Okay, so that's kind of my foundation. Moving on to the farm where I am the coordinator of a whole organic research program, but this is where most of our research takes place. This location was identified back in 1989 as a very unique piece of ground. It was historically completely pesticide-free, a very unique situation for Western Illinois. So they the faculty identified this farm. The university started renting it in 1989, and we have been negotiating leases almost every year. In the abstract, I thought it was every, when I wrote the abstract, I thought it was every year. There were a couple years where they had multi-year leases. But basically, every single year that I've been at Western, I've negotiated a lease. And it has made it a very real experience. So I understand exactly what my students are talking about, what farmers are talking about, when they talk about negotiating with a landlord for rent. And the rent has gone up every year. It's been a challenging negotiation. Anyway, so you can see where we're located. We're in Western Illinois. We are about 15 miles from the campus, north and west of the campus. I don't know if I had a pointer, I would point out, you could see Macomb in the middle square is down towards the bottom right corner, and then the farm is about 15 miles north and west. Because of the way the landlords want to have this land managed so that they can minimize their taxes, we cannot have any permanent storage structures on the farm. And that creates some serious challenges. When you look at what is left of what was a very, was clearly a very interesting farm, you could see there were some great storage facilities there at one time, but we can't use these facilities now. We can't maintain them. And so it's just, kind of when we're there and you look out at what once was there, you see monuments to some innovation that in some way it taunts us because we don't have access to them. In other ways, I think about the innovation that was happening there maybe back in the 50s to build that kind of structure. Here's an example of storage that we actually do have today. This is a Pro Box. It actually works very well, and so we have seed stored in that right now. We bought 5 of those. This is how large-scale grain producers would buy their seed, their corn or soybeans, and so we bought a number of those boxes, and we just used those for storage. Taking a look at the specific site, it's an 80-acre piece of land. We rent 77 of the acres, very high productivity soils, 2 of the highest productivity ratings in the state, Muscatoon silt loam and sable silty clay loam. You could see the U of I productivity ratings. But with the last couple years being very high production years in Illinois, we have neighbors that are, their entire farm average is well over 220. I think there was one neighbor that had a farm average over 240 bushels per acre. So this is very high productivity ground. Except for the fact that when it is wet, like the last 2 years, and you have a not completely functional tile drainage system, you can have some big challenges. And so our neighbors have fully functional tile drainage, and they are always out working the ground much earlier than we can because we have some very wet parts of some of our fields. Just to show you part of what we have to deal with, This is 2008. You could see those blue areas where we had a good stand of wheat established, and we essentially lost all of that wheat. You know, after something like that happens, and then the landlord wants you to increase your rent by $20 to $30 to $40 an acre, it's a tough negotiation. Okay, we don't own very much equipment. We had four pieces of equipment when I arrived, and now we have five. We bought a 10-foot Howard Rotovator. The equipment is stored on neighboring farms because we don't have any storage. We rent one tractor every year, about 150-horsepower tractor, and then we rent lots of equipment from neighboring farms. This is just an example of what we rented in 2007. You could see a number of tractors and then quite a few different implements. We rented one piece of equipment from an equipment dealer, a tractor. All the rest was from area farmers. So this is just an example of some of the equipment that was on the farm last year. Collaboration with neighboring farmers is absolutely essential to what we do, and I'll just say that again. We would not be able to do what we do without the collaboration with the area farmers. We pay these farmers very quickly. We keep very careful record of the acres that the equipment has gone over, the horsepower hours, and then we pay them based on U of I or Iowa State custom rate or machinery cost estimates. These are farmers that are very professional, and if we did not pay them very quickly, I think they would very quickly stop renting to us. But you know, we clean the equipment just to bring it onto an organic farm. We normally clean it when it's leaving the farm, and then we pay them promptly, and it's really been a great relationship. And I'm totally dependent on the research technician that I work with. He cultivated these relationships before I arrived, and we have maintained them, but you know, without these relationships, we wouldn't be able to do what we do. Recently, I've been looking back at some of the archive newspaper clippings, and it's very clear that we have come a long way during the history of this project. This project is 20 years old now, and when you look at some of the old clippings, you can see that one at the top, Dust Off the Cultivator, Organic Farming, A Look Back for Modern Agriculturalists. Organic farming about economics, not ethics. And these are articles from a time when organic farming was trying to justify itself, and really, people didn't see, most of the people in this community didn't see organic farming as having much promise or being innovative or, you know, being something that offered anything other than maybe, at least some years, premium prices. I think we have changed the attitude about organic farming, at least what we do at the Allison Farm during the last 3 years. For example, this is from not this year, but last year, the 2008 field day. You could see this guy launching a remote-controlled plane. This is a plane referred to as a crop cam, and he was sending this up with a pattern that he had already programmed into it, and it was going to fly over our fields and take photographs, aerial photographs of our fields. That's just one example of the types of technologies that we have been trying to implement to illustrate how, you know, we're not going to implement all the technologies that are being used in Illinois, but there are examples of innovative technologies that can serve our purposes, like maybe the crop cam. You know, we haven't paid $7,000 to buy one of those, and we haven't paid him to come back and fly our farm again. But we did buy a guidance system. We're not using auto steer yet, but we are tracking where our equipment goes across the field. We are applying some of our inputs much more uniformly now using this guidance system. So, you know, I don't think we have fully convinced people that organics equals innovation, but it wasn't too long ago that I surveyed a group of students that had been in some of my classes, and I asked them, you know, what does organic farming mean to you? And very few students said anything that really had a negative connotation. Now, of course, they were answering a question that I had asked them. So maybe they were trying to satisfy what I was looking for. But really, they went on and on about cover cropping and innovative practices and all sorts of things, which are the kind of things that I talk to them about on a regular basis in all of my classes. So maybe I'm getting this message across that organics can equal innovation. So, very quick overview of research at the Allison Farm. The early research was focused on site characterization. Subsequent research has evaluated the impact of quite a few different things: tillage systems, cover crops, crop rotation, seed treatments, crop varieties, soil amendments, and we've looked at crop yield as the principal thing we've looked at, but also seed quality, weed pressure, and economics. And the key thing to keep in mind is that this is primarily a revenue-driven farm. We are primarily spending money that we are earning from selling the crops. Last year, we, on 77 acres of cropland, well, I should say, we were renting 77 acres. We actually had about 70 acres of cropland. We had about $50,000 worth of revenue. And we only had probably $5,000 more that actually came in from other sources. The key thing to keep in mind, in addition to the fact that we're revenue driven, is that we're doing large plot farm scale type of research. So we're using standard farm equipment, and we're doing things in ways that really are designed to simulate what a farmer would do. If you want to take a look at some of our research results, I will present a little bit of data today, but on our website we have quite a bit of the historical data. If you just go to the WIU School of Agriculture website, click for the organic research program, and then you'll get to this information. It is not complete. I'm working on trying to get this fully complete with all the historical data. On that website, there's an amazing list of gratitude, or, you know, appreciation, acknowledgments of the people who have contributed. And I'm obviously not going to read through all of these. If you take a look at that website, I would encourage you just to take a glance at who has supported this project. I was reading through this actually for the first time. I read fully through all of these acknowledgments, and it really touched me to think about, you know, long before I arrived, how much support this project has received. Andy Clayton, of course, I should mention, he's the name that you won't find on the acknowledgments, because he's my research technician who has been responsible for putting up most of these acknowledgments. But he's been involved with the project for over 12 years. He's from a conventional farming background. He's farming about 1,500 acres on his own. In addition, and that's conventional production, in addition to driving 30 miles every day to come up to Macomb and work with me, and then sometimes, of course, frequently in the summer, driving another 15 miles north to the Allison Farm. Lots and lots of collaborating farmers. Lots of collaborators that have provided equipment dealers, but also all sorts of people that have just provided technical support, even if they didn't provide equipment. Lots and lots of production inputs. Very important to keep in mind, though, and I'll get to this in just a second, most of these suppliers of production inputs either provided the input for free or they provided a discount, but they didn't provide any support for the actual research evaluating the product. And this is one of the challenges. When you're doing this kind of revenue-driven research, when you're not bringing in a lot of grant money, just because you get a product, someone offers, you know, you should evaluate this for us, you still have a lot of work to do to get that product evaluated. And if they haven't provided any money, it's difficult to do that sometimes. We have a big field day every year, and my technician has done a fantastic job of lining up free products, food, all sorts of things. And so, of course, that's acknowledged as well. Okay. I just mentioned this. You know, this is an example of a product that we just evaluated, NatureSafe 1300. We found that this was a product that resulted in significant yield increases, but it was a very expensive product. It did not actually pay for the yield increases. And we haven't continued with this work because while they did give us a lot of product to work with, there was no supporting funding to do the research. One thing that might be particularly interesting to some of you is that we, since 2000, we have been doing detailed economic analysis, so we have detailed enterprise budgets, calculated on a per acre basis for most of our fields since 2000. This is just an example of a 2006 budget. Of course, many prices have changed considerably since then, but this is the kind of information that if you are interested in the economics of Midwest grain production, we have this data for corn, for soybeans, for wheat, and I think we have a little bit for hay as well. Every year we do variety trials, lots of soybeans, 10 to 15 varieties of soybeans, just a few corn hybrids. We can do small plots with soybean varieties. We always do the corn hybrids on very large farm scale plots, so we do fewer corn comparisons. Now, you guys are way too far back, I think, to have any idea what this crop is. You might be thinking that doesn't look like a crop at all. This is field pennycress. Anybody have to deal with field pennycress as a weed? Okay, well, field pennycress is a weed on our farm, but it also is an exciting new oilseed crop. Now, I'm not completely excited about it myself, but this is an oilseed crop that some researchers in Peoria, Illinois, at the USDA lab there, they had an experiment completely get away from them. It just grew up in pennycress. So they harvested the weeds, and they found that it had higher quantity and quality of oil than anything they were expecting from their experimental lines, and they didn't plant pennycress. So we did the very first nitrogen rate study on field pennycress, and we found that it did, you can't really see the numbers there, it did respond a little bit up to about 50 pounds of N per acre. So, you know, this is an example of something that you probably wouldn't expect to happen on an organic research farm, but we had a liquid nitrogen product that we had used on some wheat, and so we decided to try it on some field pennycress. And we did actually plant this pennycress. Okay, very quickly, I'm going to take you through kind of a sequence of experiments that we've been doing looking at cover crops. Cover crops has been kind of a central focus in terms of the innovative new research that we're doing at the Allison Farm. That strip that you could see central in the slide is forage radish. It had the ground had been in wheat where we frost-seeded red clover. We tilled out some strips and we seeded the forage radish as a solid stand there. If you're familiar with Steve Groff's work in Pennsylvania, that would be the tillage radish that Steve has been selling recently. So the tillage radish died. It's, you know, only winter hardy down to about maybe 20 degrees. We didn't apply any nitrogen. We had the tillage radish strips, but then we also had tillage radish no-tilled into red clover and also tillage radish plus oats no-tilled into red clover. So we planted May 29th. We had a local farmer come over with his 16-row planter, a little bit easier than planting with a 4-row planter. But, of course, when you're working with 10-foot-wide strips and you're using a piece of equipment that's 40 feet wide, it creates some interesting challenges. Anyway, very briefly, we observed quickly that there was much less weed pressure in the radish where we had the solid radish. But what was most interesting is when we got to the end of the game here. Take a look at these yield results. This is with no nitrogen applied. The reality, though, is, of course, you know, when we have someone come over with a combine, all of the neighbors are harvesting with yield monitors these days, so they quickly give us these yield monitor results. You know, that's not good enough for doing plot research. So we also had a weigh wagon on the farm at that time, and so we were able to correct these yields, and they were, you could see, substantially different. When you look at these numbers, you could see that there's some variability in some of the treatments, but when you compare clover oats, for example, versus solid radish, that's a contrast that was significant at 0.05, and some of the other contrasts were significant as well. And these are pretty respectable yields for no nitrogen applied at all. Okay, so that was generation one of our tillage radish experiment. Next generation we planted last fall, and I'll show you some very quick sequence of pictures. This was a tillage system experiment comparing three different tillage systems, conventional till, minimum till, and no till. What you could see here is on 30-inch rows we have radish, and this was not the tillage radish. This was a radish called grazer radish planted with oats. The radish is on 30-inch rows with oats on the inter-row. So we'll just go through this very quickly. Here you can see the radish dying back now. This was in November. We just had a frost, I think, down to about 18 degrees. Okay, now the oats and radishes have died. You can see some flooding across the center of that plot. We have a lot of flooding that occurs in the wintertime. Now things are greening up in March. Now it's April, the cereal rye, which is where we'll have our no-till systems. The rye is growing quite quickly. Now you can see, what you see right in the middle is, if you look closely, you can see where the radish had been. The oat residue persists, but the radish has pretty much melted away, and so it looks kind of like strip till. You could see those four strips. And then on the far left, you could see the rye quite tall. So now we have tilled out the conventional till strips, but the minimum till haven't been tilled yet, and the rye is very tall. Now we've tilled, we're finishing up tilling out all of the strips. This was the day of planting, the first week of June. And what you can also see is that the rye has been rolled. Okay, now we're planting. Had a neighbor come over, bring over his no-till John Deere 750 drill. Our strips are only 10 feet wide. This was a 15-foot wide drill, so I had to ride in the back and very carefully just put the seed down, you know, a selection of the seed tubes. So we're planting the soybeans into the rye. 1 week after planting, really nothing had come up through the rye, but you could see, you can row those beans in the tilled plots. About 2 weeks later, beans are coming up through the rye. Now, this is about a month later. You can see what the stands look like. There you can see the beans coming up through the rye. It was not the stand we had hoped in the rye. There were some patches where there was basically nothing that came up. But in most places, it was a stand that was good enough that if the rye was able to provide persistent weed control, it was going to work. And we just didn't know what was going to happen. And as it continued to rain, we were getting really concerned. But the rye did provide persistent weed control. I know this isn't what always happens with organic no-till systems, but this system did work very well for us this year. Okay, so here you could see, these are beans planted on rows and the canopy is closed very well. Now, you could see that some of these strips, 10-foot wide strips, are greener than others. Those were the no-till strips. They stayed green longer than the row beans. And here's what it looked like just 2 days ago, last time I looked at the farm before I came to Pennsylvania. And that strip in the middle is a no-till strip. Okay, so now we're moving on to the next generation. I wish I could tell you some yields from that experiment, but we haven't harvested yet. Okay, now we have another experiment that we started this fall, September 2009. We were out there with this same John Deere 750 drill, and we were planting radishes this time. I don't think I mentioned, last year I used a push planter, a hand planter to push in those radishes planted on 30-inch rows. This year I took some cups, cut out the bottom, sticky taped them, basically double stick taped them down to the inside box of the, you know, this was a drill that only had one box, and so we were able to plant our radishes on 30-inch rows using this drill. Not exactly a small plot planter, but it did the job. Okay, and now you could see those are the radishes on 30-inch rows taken 2 days ago with oats in between. And this is the solid seeded radish. So basically, we were planting 10 pounds of radish to the acre, solid seeded on 7.5-inch rows, but we also were planting 2.5 pounds of radish to the acre with oats at about 1.5 bushels to the acre. Okay. A lot of organic farmers in the Midwest had situations like this year, and we did as well. When you have very wet conditions during your cultivation times, it's extremely difficult to use traditional organic weed management practices. We heard James refer to that And we had this happen also on some of our fields. You saw in that experiment, the tillage system experiment, we had very clean conditions. But so on the same farm, you know, less than a quarter mile away, we had situations like this. Now, we've looked at those beans. Out in those weeds, we probably have over 35 bushels to the acre. So that's a harvest that, when you consider organic prices, will actually exceed the revenue of conventional soybeans. But, you know, this is a vicious cycle that just gets more vicious as you return all of that seed to the soil. So in response to that, we've set up a new experiment. And this experiment is really changing the way we look at weed management. We wanted to put into place an experiment where we started controlling the weeds 6 months in advance. So we looked at the most successful method of weed control that has ever worked on this farm, which was ridge-till. They went away from ridge-till because they were doing ridge-till on 36-inch rows and they couldn't get anyone to harvest. But Andy looks, my technician looks back very fondly to those days when even on wet years they had good in-row weed control. We haven't had that good in-row weed control during wet years since they went away from ridge-till. So we have ridges that were formed here, and then we have, you could see those green strips, that's where it's going to be organic no-till. And this is a much larger scale experiment. The tillage system experiment that I just showed you, those were strips 10 feet wide, 500 feet long. This is 30 feet wide, a quarter mile long. So basically we're kind of comparing two different approaches, kind of the new and the old, of providing weed control that we start way in advance, we put a system into place that won't promote all of that flush of weeds with the pre-plant tillage that is just basic to traditional organic systems. We have some really big tools that have come to the farm recently. We did not purchase this one. This is just an example of something that was brought to the farm. We had a summer intern this year who was just a really interesting guy, very mechanically oriented, and he also works for a company called Salford. Salford is a equipment dealer. And so he brought this tool to us, and we demoed it during the summer. There Brent is right there, and I'm going to spend the rest of the time, just a few minutes now, kind of looking at how students have been directly involved with the farm. To me, probably this is more important than any of the research. I think these projects that I've just gone through, the sequence of, you know, evolution of cover cropping research is interesting, but having the students connected is what really is most important to me. And here we have Brent with my technician on the lower right, and then a local farmer. You know, they're out there having the experience that, you know, I wish all of my students could have, really looking at how things are working in the soil on this organic farm. Okay, probably the number one thing I've done to bring the most students out to the farm is I've started having twilight tours in the fall. Our field day would be great to have students come to, but it's in the summer. They're busy farming. So we've had these tours in the fall, two tours last year, three tours this year. Over, you know, over all of the tours, we've had over 100 people come to the farm, about 60 students, maybe 20 farmers, and, you know, at least 20 other people. And basically, these are completely informal. It's just students and farmers talking together about, what do we see? You know, is organic working? Does this look like what we expected organic to look like? You know, what is it, what's the yield going to be like? You know, I have my students out there estimating yield in that soybean variety trial on the right there. We even had a few politicians come out. I was really pleased to have our state rep, Rich Myers, come out. And I was also really pleased that that was the day when we had over 40 students come out. So that was a nice thing to have that happen simultaneously. But things were really beautiful that evening. And, you know, I think Rich Myers is from a conventional ag background. I had talked to him previously about organics, and he really, you know, did not think of organics as innovation. I would guess that his perspective is a little different now. So why did so many students with conventional ag backgrounds decide to come out to an organic research farm? You might be thinking, well, because Joel offered them extra credit or things like that. And, you know, there were a few students who did negotiate with that me later, but that with me later. But I think the main reason is that I show pictures of the Allison Farm in all of my classes. And I'm posing questions all the time, asking the students to help me solve these problems. Like this engineering problem. You know, this is a slide that I just pulled out of one of my lectures. Engineering problem for you to solve. How can we collect or kill weed seeds in the chaff as it's coming out of the combine? You know, I have a lot of students that are just very mechanically oriented, and they like to think about problems like this. Probably the number one thing that I've done that has really engaged students in thinking about the Allison Farm and the kind of the ongoing cover crop research is the Cover Crop Innovator Project. This was a project my soil fertility students did last fall, and I paired up 45 students with 45 farmers across the Midwest. You can see where they were located, that were using cover crops on a large scale. Five of them were organic farms, 40 were conventional farms. These were all farmers using cover crops successfully in grain production systems. Every student interviewed a farmer, wrote up a 2-to-4-page profile, and then these things ended up, well, first of all, we burned a CD for every student and for every farmer, and then they ended up online on the Midwest Cover Crop Council website. It was such a success that I decided to do it again. But you can imagine, the first 45 farmers were hard to find. Finding another 40 large-scale grain farmers using cover crops was particularly hard. But they're working on it right now, and I was responding to a bunch of emails last night encouraging students that were trying to figure out, you know, how to respond to some of these farmers that are very busy harvesting right now, so they're not answering the questions. Okay. This is just an example of some feedback that one of the students got. The farmer, Joe Nestor, replied, "We just interseeded 14,000 acres of corn and soybeans with annual rye." That was the largest, okay? But we are talking about large-scale grain producers telling their stories in a way that I don't think has ever been told before. And this really was appealing to my students. Many of these students told me later, subsequent semesters, that they read through the entire collection and that it was something that they enjoyed doing over the Christmas break. And then many of these farmers, they were innovating in isolation. They knew almost none of these other farmers that were using cover crops. And so they were really appreciative to get the full collection. Okay, so that was just the aerial seeding with the helicopter. Here we have one of the farmers down in southern Illinois who's doing about 2,500 acres of grains, and he's doing some continuous corn with hairy vetch in Illinois. And you could see at least some years it really works well. Okay. One other thing I want to mention real quickly. Anybody ever heard of the forum New Ag Talk? Well, I'm not surprised that, a scientific audience is not familiar, but this is a forum that's probably the number one forum that farmers are using to discuss new technologies. And this was one of the ways that I helped to line up some of these farmers. This is also a way that I'm engaging the farming community and thinking about what we're doing at the Allison Farm. And so, I regularly post emails like this where I'd say, I took a bunch of photos. These farmers, most of them have never thought about organics before, but they're enjoying, at least some of them seem to be enjoying dialoguing about organics. Okay, so just to kind of bring this to a close, we had five of the cover crop innovators come out to our field day this year because the focus of the field day really followed right out of that cover crop innovator project. The focus was cover crop innovation. So the students that wrote those interviews, they were all, that did the interviews and wrote the profiles, they were all invited. I only got three of them to come. I only got five of the 45 farmers to come. But it just was, it was a great example in my mind of how we can have this integration between what happens in the classroom and what happens out at the farm. Okay. I also take students to other field days where I want students to be interacting directly with farmers and talking with farmers about innovation. Okay. I'll just quickly go through this. This was just another example of taking some students out to an activity that really developed some rapport with some local farmers. Okay. The very last thing that I want to show you is we are doing some direct marketing, not of our commodity corn soil, well, of our, you know, large-scale yellow number two dent soybeans and wheat. But we are doing a little bit of specialty crop production, like purple and gold popcorn. Our school colors are purple and gold, and so we've been having fun with this purple and gold theme. Here we have a student worker that was helping me bag up some popcorn. There you can see an example of a bag, half-pound bag there, selling for $2, $4 a pound, you know, harvesting over 3,000 pounds to the acre. You know, the revenue is pretty significant. Okay. They're selling at a football game just a few days ago. Our latest product is Rocky Popcorn. Rocky is our mascot, and this was a business student that came to me and said, I want to turn your product into something that students will buy. Faculty and staff were buying these half-pound bags of popcorn, but students, most of them have never eaten any they've never popped any popcorn that wasn't in a microwave. So this product seems to be working very well. We started with a run of 1,200 bags, and we've already sold about half of them. Okay. Purple and gold beans, carrots, sweet potatoes. Just a few things that we are playing with. I'll just leave you with this. We need to think about how to engage students and farmers in thinking about innovation. Not just organic innovation, but innovation that doesn't just happen in a laboratory by people with a white coat on. Farmers are paying through the nose right now for technology that you can look at it as being very innovative, but it is not innovation that is designed specifically for a specific farm. And so really what I'm trying to do is broader than organics, but is within the context of organics, to encourage people to become part of a learning community of agricultural innovation. So thank you very much.